I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When we discuss the budget, we discuss our deepest values as a state, says Dwayne Gosin. Today, the former budget director for Kansas shares his view on the state's current financial crisis. As lawmakers struggle to cover a $342 million shortfall, are they showing residents what they value? Then, the writer who addresses themes that few young adult authors visit, addiction, sexual abuse, and teen pregnancy. Find out why this best-selling novelist prefers to face messy issues head-on and uses her own family experiences as the starting point. Later, we'll bring you this week's State House Blend, Kansas. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. $1 billion. That's the size of the Kansas budget shortfall the next couple of years. Lawmakers in Topeka are scrambling these days to close it, but now one step that lawmakers and Governor Sam Brownback had hoped to avoid seems to be in the offing, and that's cuts to the state's public schools. Here to explain the challenge before lawmakers, and it's a considerable one, is Dwayne Gosin. He's a senior fellow at the Kansas Center for Economic Growth. He served seven terms in the Kansas House and was budget director for 12 years under three governors, both Democrat and Republican. And Dwayne, it's nice to have you again. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve. Happy to be here.
I should point out he's been traveling the state, speaking to groups to fill them in on deep concerns that he has about the state's direction here. We hope to have Kansas Budget Director Sean Sullivan on the show soon to offer his point of view on all this. Dwayne, $1 billion in cuts over the next 2 years. That sounds like a whole lot of money. Can you put that amount in context for us? I mean, how big a bite of the apple is that?
The Kansas general fund budget is about a $6 billion deal, so $1 billion out of that is huge.
Big chunk.
It's big bucks.
Does all this financial pain stem from the legislature's decision back in 2012 to cut taxes?
Yes. The basic problem that Kansas has is that it doesn't have nearly enough income, money coming in the door, revenue, in order to pay its ongoing regular expenses. And it's essentially Kansas is short about $800 million a year in being able to meet expenses. And that's not a new situation. That's been true ever since the 2012 tax cuts went into effect. As soon as those tax cuts went into effect, revenue to the state general fund just dropped like a rock. And Kansas has been sweating out that problem ever since.
You know, is it possible, Dwayne, that this was all part of a grand plan? Governor Sam Brownback is a conservative. A lot of his allies in the legislature are conservative. Maybe this was the result they were aiming at, and this is exactly what they want to see happen.
It could be. At the beginning, the premise for these tax cuts was that they would create an economic boom in Kansas, that cutting taxes so swiftly, so fast, would create enough economic activity that the state economy would really jump up and jump up fast enough and be good enough that tax revenue would still come in at a regular rate to the state budget, and the state budget would be fine. Kind of a almost a magic situation.
A shot of adrenaline is what Governor Brownback called it at the time.
It sounds great, and it's very seductive to be able to say, oh, we're going to cut taxes, and the economy's going to boom, and the budget's going to be fine. But of course, it hasn't worked out that way.
He also says, the governor does, that other sectors of the Kansas economy have stalled. Prices for crops, oil and gas, aviation, manufacturing, the Wichita area have slumped. He insists that the tax cuts have had exactly the desired effect. Does he have a point?
Yes, the part of the Kansas economy that depends on oil and gas prices and ag prices has been certainly pressed in the last year or so. But the problems with the Kansas budget originated far before that. The income loss to the state budget occurred immediately after the tax cuts went into effect. And yes, the ag prices and oil prices have made things a little bit worse. But if the Kansas budget were set up in such a way for a solid financial position, Kansas would be able to weather those ups and downs of the economy and be okay. We're not in a recession now. We've got some slumps in a few areas, but Kansas should have a financial system in place that allows the state to weather that kind of up and down that's normal in the cycle.
We're talking about the state of the Kansas budget with former Kansas budget director Dwayne Gosin. Remind us, Dwayne, what taxes were cut back in 2012? What happened there?
There were two big things. The state cut income tax rates that people pay, and the state also exempted what's sometimes called business income from income tax liability entirely. And the way that works is that individuals who earn income through a business, through a limited liability corporation, through self-employment, through farm income, through rental income, any of that business income that an individual reports on their tax return, that's now all income tax free for state income taxes in Kansas. And so it has set up a situation where essentially the people who earn money through a paycheck, they pay income taxes.
I was just going to say, yeah, the secretary in a company pays taxes, yes. But maybe the owner of the company is not.
Yes.
Yeah.
It sets up a really unfair situation. And I think by and large, lots and lots of Kansans have recognized that as unfair. And that's the prime target for change now as the legislature tries to figure out how to solve this situation.
I was going to say, you talked about limited liability corporations. This is the LLC loophole that's getting talked about so much in Topeka right now. That's the parlance for what this all is.
Okay. Yes.
You just wrote about this LLC loophole in one of your columns that gets distributed across the state, Dwayne. And you said the time has come that which you said has come to epitomize budget-busting tax policy in Kansas, this LLC loophole. Explain that to us and explain, why that's such a budget-busting tax policy.
Well, all of this business income was exempted from income tax liability completely. And coupled with the income tax rate reductions, that has caused an enormous loss of revenue to the state general fund.
Mm-hmm.
Of the two things, Kansans have recognized the LLC loophole or the business income exemption to be pretty unfair.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the target is for change. That's come to epitomize the problems that Kansas has had with its income and its revenue collections.
But the point of your column was even if you close that loophole, that's not going to be enough to solve the budget problem in and of itself.
The problem that Kansas has become so severe, about an $800 million a year difference between income coming in and expenses going out, that closing the loophole will not cover or bring balance back to the Kansas budget. It will help, but the solution is going to have to be more than that. Closing the loophole probably brings in maybe around $300 million.
That's still less than half of what's needed.
Less than half of what's needed.
Mm-hmm.
Lawmakers are going to have to look for a more comprehensive solution than that. They're going to have to consider raising the upper income tax rate back up where it once was. They may need to consider other solutions as well. But in order to get the Kansas budget structurally balanced again, it's going to take closing the loophole plus a number of other things.
Our phone number here, if you want to ask Dwayne a question about the state of the Kansas budget, 816 816- 215-235-2888 is the number. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, as you get around the state and you speak to various groups about something as, at least on one level, not so interesting, which is the Kansas budget, what kind of crowds are you getting? What kind of interest are you seeing in all things Kansas budget these days?
Well, it's been really interesting to me because I like talking about the budget because that's what I've done professionally. So it's a fun thing for me to go do a program on state budgeting. But for most people, I recognize fully that for most people, talking about the state budget and state finances isn't the kind of thing they really want to do on a Tuesday night. But we've been getting great crowds, people who otherwise might not be paying attention to budgeting things, who've been coming out and are interested because they have recognized that something's gone wrong in Kansas and citizens need to be engaged in figuring out the solution.
I was going to say, what do you make of that, the fact you're getting reasonable crowds and lots of interest here? What's the conclusion you draw from that?
The conclusion is that people have recognized that the state budget isn't working like it should, and they're worried. They're worried about things like education funding, highway funding, and key services that they depend on. And they realize that those things are in jeopardy if the state doesn't fix this up.
Yeah. Well, talk to me about highway funding for a moment, because when Governor Brownback talks about things that are going right in Kansas, he oftentimes mentions the highways. They're pretty smooth. Driving from here to Topeka on the Turnpike is a pretty smooth experience. So what's the issue?
Kansas has had good roads and does have good roads because we have invested in them. And that has been a priority for many, many lawmakers. But because of the budget crisis that we've been experiencing now over the last 4 years, Kansas has taken enormous amounts out of the highway fund and put that money into the general fund just to help the state budget scrape by.
How much money?
By now, it's over $2 billion in that period of money taken from the highway fund and used for something else other than highways.
To what extent has that wiped out money available to fix any road in the state for anything?
Certainly, Kansas has been canceling road projects, has been cutting back on maintenance, and that's not the kind of thing that you see show up on the road immediately. But if Kansas doesn't continue to invest, if Kansas stays on this course of taking money out of roads and cutting back on maintenance and road projects, that's going to show up soon. And that's not going to be something citizens really appreciate.
Making up that amount of money, $2 billion, that's going to take a while, though, right?
It's going to take a long time, and it has put the highway fund in a terrific pinch.
816-235-2888 is the number. We're talking the Kansas budget. Lots of people are calling in to talk about the budget, Dwayne. Let's go to some calls right now. This is Eric from Olathe. Eric, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. I am a small business owner, and I incorporated, so the LLC loophole affects me, but I just wanted to make the comment that I thought it was a little misspoken to say that all business income is not taxed, because the way it affects me is my business income and my W-2 income is taxed. It's just my dividend income that is not taxed at the state level. So I just wanted to clarify that a little bit, that it's not all business income.
Dwayne?
It's any business income that flows through to an individual income tax form. And different people handle that differently on their taxes, but it's that kind of income.
My W-2 income, which is my business income, I pay myself a salary, and my W-2 income is taxed at the normal state rate.
Sure, if you pay yourself a salary, that would be true.
Well, and if you're incorporated, generally, I think that's the case. I don't think too many guys get away with just paying themselves dividend income. Probably maybe some do, But that's just my point. I wanted to clarify that it's not all business income, because it sounded like that's what you were saying, that any business is not taxed.
Yeah, Eric, just hang on half a second. Just, you want to say anything else here, Duane, about this?
The salary income or paycheck income that a person receives, that is taxable, and people pay taxes on that. But it's the business income, profits, net income that does not come through a paycheck, which is tax-free.
Can people then benefit from that money? Can they put that in their pocket and not pay taxes on it?
It's a tax cut.
Okay. Let's go
and,
on.
And there's no requirement that that tax cut or the benefit from that tax cut be used to create a job or do anything else. People are free to do what they want with it.
From your vantage point, was that a mistake in the original legislation, this notion that there was no requirement to create jobs that was connected to this tax cut?
If the goal of the tax cut is to create jobs, then the tax cut should be targeted. There should be some requirement in order to make the tax cut effective.
Mm-hmm.
What happened with this particular policy is the tax cut was just given, and it was hoped that people would create jobs. But that obviously hasn't happened, because our job growth has been very anemic and behind our neighboring states and behind the U.S. averages.
Let's go to Mike from South Kansas City. Mike, you're on Up to Date with Duane Gosin. Good morning.
Good morning. My comment is, with the defeat of several conservative Republicans at the last election, and I think they were supposed to be replaced by more moderate, and also the addition maybe of one or two Democrats, I were elected to fix the damn budget. So, anyways, I'm surprised that they continue to go on like they have the same legislature that was voted out.
Right. So there are more Democrats in the legislature, more moderate Republicans. Duane, why hasn't this problem gone away?
One third of the legislature is new, for the very reason that the caller is outlining, and lawmakers right now are grappling with this problem and trying to figure out how to fix it. And I truly believe that there's a majority in both the House and in the Senate of legislators who know that this problem must be fixed and are working very, very hard to fix it. It's just that the problem has become so immense that it's a very, very difficult thing to do.
And at
there are basically two solutions to this. Either you cut expenses even more than they've already been cut, or you raise revenue to close the gap. And it's no longer realistic or responsible to do this only on the expense side. And so lawmakers have to raise revenue, and that's hard. That's hard even in a situation where they know they have to do it. But they're working at it, and I'm hopeful that they can produce a comprehensive solution to this.
And it's particularly difficult, Duane, because not only will these tax increases perhaps require simple majorities to pass, you might need extraordinary majorities, because Governor Sam Brownback has indicated some of these revenue increases, these tax increases, he very well might veto. So to get these increases past him, you'd have to override those vetoes with extraordinary majorities.
Right. If we had a governor who was leading toward a solution that is structurally balanced, that would be a much easier situation for the legislature. But the legislature essentially has to create this solution on their own. 165 legislators are working at that and trying to find a common solution, and they're working hard at it, but that's not an easy task.
Mark from Lee Summit. Mark, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, guys. My question was, it seems like Kansas taxes the heck out of groceries, unlike most, or if not all, other states. And I know there's been support in the legislature, at least lip service, to the prospect of reducing that tax. And it just doesn't seem like there's any chance at all now that could go through. I haven't heard a price tag on what that might cost, but it just seems like it would render that undoable this year.
Yeah, how can that be, Duane? And Mark raises such an interesting point, that Kansas has these vast budget deficits, and yet it has one of the highest sales taxes on food of any state in the nation.
after the income tax cuts passed and Kansas faced this big gap between income and expense, one of the things that lawmakers did to try to close that gap was to raise sales tax rates. But that has left Kansas with basically the highest food sales tax rate in the nation. Most states that have a sales tax in some way or another give food a break or exempt food from sales tax. Kansas does not at all, and food has the full sales tax against it. So that makes our sales tax rate on food pretty high. But the problem that we've got now, I know there are lots of folks and lots of legislators who'd like to reduce it, but if you reduce the sales tax on food now when we're already starved for income and revenue, that means something else has to be raised even higher in order to compensate.
Let's go to Dale from Kansas City, Kansas. Dale, you're on Up to Date, and we're talking about the state of the Kansas budget. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I wanted your guests to explain the problem that the state agencies are having when they talk about a 5 or 6% shortfall in funding for the remainder of the fiscal year. What really is the impact on the agency? Because my memory serves me correctly, it'll be closer to double given what time is left in the year. Would you explain that?
Kansas is currently in what we call fiscal year 2017. The fiscal year started July 1, and it's going to end on June 30. So there's about 4 months left in this fiscal year. And one of the things that lawmakers have to do is they've already moved a whole lot of money from the highway fund in this fiscal year, but they still have $350 million to go yet to try to figure out how to close the gap on this current fiscal year. And if they end up closing that gap by cutting back on state agencies, that means that state agencies, let's say there's a 5% cut that then has to be applied right at the tail end of the fiscal year, that can be terrifically hard for an agency to swallow that.
I hope that helps, Dale.
Well, okay, and I'm going to address it a little more directly. My experience in past years, and I've worked in another state, when the state offices do that to you, you're looking at maybe having to cut your budget for the remainder of the year 10, 15%, at least double to triple of what, given the remaining time for the fiscal year.
I think that's your point, Duane.
Yes, it would be extremely hard for any agency to take a even a small cut yet this fiscal year. But the options open to lawmakers are pretty limited. What lawmakers are talking most seriously about is simply borrowing the money to get through the rest of this fiscal year.
I was going to say the governor is proposing liquidating a long-term investment fund and selling off the state's future proceeds from a settlement with tobacco companies to get cash now. What do you think?
Selling off the tobacco settlement proceeds is a terrible financial idea because it's like a big payday loan. You give up 30 years of steady income into the state general fund or into the Kansas Treasury, and in return for a lump sum that gets spent immediately.
It's short term.
It is short term.
And maybe not so wise from your standpoint.
It's unwise and does not fix the problem that Kansas faces.
Okay, let's go to John from Lawrence. John, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you for the call. Just have a quick question. The Kansas Unemployment Security Tax Fund this year received a 50% increase. As a small business owner, I have to pay it. My taxes went up 50%. And the only reason that I can see, I mean, the money never comes out of it. I never have to take it out. It's basically the state holds my money for me in an account.
Hang on a second, John. Is this something you're familiar with, Duane?
I'm not terribly familiar with the situation. It's not something that affects the state general fund budget problem that
John, I'm sorry. I'm going to scoot on and grab another call here. David from Overland Park. David, you're on Up to Date.
Hi. I was just wondering, so say when they were supposed to vote on the closing the LLC loophole, if they had closed it then and it was approved, what else would the state have to do to close that budget shortfall a bit more?
You need another $400 million or so, right,
yes,
Dwayne?
This afternoon, the Senate Tax Committee is going to be looking at a plan that both closes the LLC loophole and raises the upper income tax bracket back up to where it once was.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a more comprehensive approach to the problem that the state faces.
Bottom line is, these are issues that are going to affect the pocketbooks of a lot of Kansans. This would be a great time for folks to tune in and keep an eye on what's going on, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Dwayne Gosin will be one of the speakers Thursday at a roundtable titled Kansas's Cautionary Tax Tale, a Model of What Not to Do. It'll be at 7 o'clock at the Matt Ross Community Center out in Overland Park. We'll post a link to that event on our website, kcur.org/up-to-date. And Dwayne, it's always great to have you here. Thanks for your very sober analysis of a lot of stuff going on in Kansas right now.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with an author who talks to teens in some very direct ways. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And here we go again. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, the BBC was here to get your reactions to the first few weeks of the Trump administration, and you didn't disappoint. You can find that conversation online at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow on the show, learn about the increasing amount of GMOs in grocery stores and check in on what we can expect from the new Secretary of Agriculture. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Ellen Hopkins is known for going where few, if any, young adult authors go: addiction, incest, sexual abuse. Her latest novel, The You I've Never Known, dives into some of her personal history and the kidnapping of a daughter by an angry father. Ellen Hopkins has penned more than a dozen teen novels, beginning with Crank, published in 2004, that hit the top of the bestseller charts. That story was, again, loosely based on her daughter's struggles with crystal meth. These aren't conventional novels. Ellen Hopkins relies on poetry, and it's led to her being described as the best-selling living poet in the country. Ellen joins us now via Skype. And Ellen, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, you don't shy away from big, hot, messy issues, and I'm wondering why not.
Because those big, hot, messy issues touch teen lives every single day and lots of teens every single day. And so I think it's vital for people to develop some empathy and understanding for young people going through these kinds of things. And also for those kids to know they're not alone, that somebody cares enough to write about them, about their struggles.
I gather, you know, now I've read that there are lots of young adult authors writing about some of these things. But back when you broke in, you know, a decade ago, there wasn't nearly as much of this direct talk, frank talk to teens. Were young adult authors missing the boat back then?
I think, you know, we've kind of evolved as a society, and we continue to do that. You know, for most, way, way back, women and children who are going through things were told pretty much to be quiet, to shut up and just don't talk about those things, pushed into, you know, closets and into corners. And now we're asking them to come out and get help and ask for help and share their stories so that they can move forward into a better place. So I think there was a fear on the part of a lot of authors to touch those subjects. And I'm glad that, you know, I've been able to be instrumental in that. Is, of course, gratifying, but I'm glad that we're able to talk about those things now.
You know, Ellen, it's been said of you that you meet kids where they are, but you ain't a kid anymore. And I'm wondering, so how do you know where they are?
I go where they are. First of all, I do a lot of school visits, a lot of high schools. I'm down in middle schools and high schools a lot, and I talk to kids online. I've raised one generation of kids up into their 30s. I've raised another one we adopted. He's 20, and now I'm raising three young grandchildren. So I've had kids around me. I guess I'll always have kids around me looking at it now. But
so the story in your latest book, The You I've Never Known, centers on a girl whose father has kidnapped her. Turns out the same thing happened in your life. Tell us about that.
That's true. 3 weeks after I divorced my ex-husband, he kidnapped our then 3-year-old daughter out of daycare, and I lost her for three years. So he was moving around the country, back then there were no cell phones, so I was getting payphone calls, ostensibly from Kelly, but they were always from him taunting me, telling me I'd never get her back. And eventually he did settle back into his kind of hometown area in Indiana. And it was actually his grandma that called up. She says, you know, it just ain't right what that boy's doing to that little girl. And she helped me get her back.
What were those 3 years like for you?
Fearful, angry, trying to find her, tracking her down, having leads. We even connected a couple times only to have him kind of jerk her back away out from under us. So they were pretty painful. And, you know, I lost, you know, that those years from 3 to 6, that's a real developmentally. Mm-hmm. It's an important time for children, but also for that parental connection. So it took us quite a while to reconnect on that real deep level. Now we're actually best friends. She lives close with her family and we do a lot of things together, and I'm glad for that. But it was quite difficult.
Novelist Ellen Hopkins, whose latest book, The You I've Never Known, is my guest. A lot of people wouldn't want to reveal a personal history in the way you do. Why were you okay with it?
Well, with the first book, with Crank, that one, I wasn't going to write young adult, to tell you the truth. I thought I was going to write picture books, which is not my skill set at all. I did want to write for young people, though, and had been publishing nonfiction for young people. Mm-hmm. But when this story, when she fell into this addiction, and this was a kid that had everything going for her, you know, straight A-plus kid, yeah. She had big dreams, and she met the wrong guy, and really, I mean, one bad choice. We've been dealing with that addiction now for 21 years. So I wanted to write for teens because I wanted to turn them away from making that choice if I could. And I know I've done that because of the letters I've gotten. And so, you know, it's that. Then I developed this kind of respect for this young generation when I started to see some of the things that they were going through, you know, beyond even addiction, because they come and start sharing their stories with me. It's like, okay, I need to start representing you in books.
You know, in this latest book, you place your protagonist in the most untenable of positions. I mean, she begins to wonder if her dad is lying to her and has been her entire life. And at the same time, she's been taught for years to mistrust her mom. I mean, that's a heck of a headbanger, Ellen. I mean, why is a story like that appealing to teenagers?
Because they're looking for who they are, you know, and really this girl, she's been looking for who she is. She's, you know, she's 17, almost 18, and she, that's a real time of discovery and trying to figure out, you know, where you belong on the gender spectrum and where you belong as, you know, what you want for your future, what your dreams are, what you want to be, you know, and so they finally settle in, and she's had a whole year at school, in one school, which is something she's never had. And she's got friends, and she's got love interests, and she's really starting to feel like, oh, yes, this is me unfolding. And then she discovers that really her entire life is based on lies. But that, for young people, even without the base of lies, knowing who they are at 17 and 18 is a big, you know, struggle for them.
Yeah. You know, you touch in the book on this emotional control that Ariel's father exerts over her, but you also speak of love and dependence between the two. That's kind of a complex set of ideas. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, of course, because he's all she's had. And so she's had, I mean, and he does. He tells her, you know, I'm the only person in the world that loves you. And if you've been told that, you know, your entire childhood, you will believe that. And he does in a way. I mean, he does love her. I'm not saying he doesn't. He absolutely does. But it's the control of her that he's really after, more than, you know, that kind of young child's adoration of their father. He wants control of her. And that, you know, in the real life situation, that was definitely true as well.
You know, I also got to ask the obvious thing here. You write in poetry. You write in verse, at least most of the time. Why do you do it, and why do you think it works?
The verse, what it does is it pulls you, because poetry is about how the poet views the world, right? So mm-hmm. You're pulled inside the poet's head, and you're looking out through the poet's eyes when you read poetry, if poetry is done well. And so it tends to pull readers on onto the pages, so it feels more like they're experiencing the story than being told a story, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And also the disparity of language, the imagery, all the great poetic devices, you know, metaphor, alliteration, all those things read subconsciously. So kids love that. They don't know it maybe, but they do. They love it. Hmm. And then there's also the kids that don't read that well. And so the fewer words on the page, the less dense text is really appealing to kids who think they don't like to read or, you know, don't want to read. Often they're just pulled right in because they can read it so quickly.
Hmm. And speed's important these days, isn't it? They want to feel like they're accomplishing something.
Right. And I mean, if you look at my books, they're big, fat books. So once they get all the way through them, so there are no fewer words in total than any other real novel. You know, there are 85,000 mm-hmm. words, but they can read them quickly and grasp them. And it makes them feel proud to be able to read such a big book, you know.
Yeah. You went to school for journalism, but you didn't finish your degree. Why did you leave and why the interest in journalism?
Because I love facts. Mm-hmm. And if I was starting over now, I would definitely go straight back into journalism because this is a time that when we need facts and truth telling. I left because I met Mr. Wrong and got married, which was not the brightest thing to do, but you know, every step, everything I've accomplished in my life, everything I've not accomplished in my life has led me here. So I feel like I've been put on this path, and I don't regret not finishing school. But I would encourage people that want to write now to consider journalism because there's a real need for good, solid investigative journalism now and going forward, I believe. So I'm encouraging young people when I talk to young people about who want to write for a living to think about nonfiction, to think about journalism and not just fiction.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here, Ellen, because I teach it up at University of Missouri, Kansas City. So I'm glad to have the endorsement from you. And I should just point out again, Ellen Hopkins is the author of The You I've Never Known. Such an interesting story. Ellen, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It's time now for State House Blend. This week's episode focuses on the Kansas state budget. Imagine that. Host Sam Zeff speaks with Republican State Senator Barbara Beaulieu of the 7th District that covers Northeast Johnson County.
Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Senator Barbara Beaulieu.
Joining Barbara and me in the KCUR 89.3 production studio, my friend and colleague, Brian Lowry. Brian, thanks for being back.
Thanks for having me.
I want to play a couple of clips of tape here from your freshman moderate Republican colleagues in the Senate. First, we're going to hear from John Scoobel from Overland Park and then Dinah Sykes from Lenexa.
In the last month of the campaign, what we heard door to door was fix this mess. And I think that that's what we signed on for is to fix this mess.
I have to be able to see 1 year, 2 years, and then if I have to make cuts, I can do that knowing the plan is in place to get us on the path we need.
So two things I want to hear from you, Barbara. One, do you feel that you were sent to the state Senate to fix this mess?
100%.
And two, you heard Dinah Sykes say that, suggest that she's willing to take some cuts to higher education, to K-12, if you can get a structurally balanced budget in the next couple of years. Where are you on that?
We are all searching for ways to find possibilities, particularly to not cut K-12. It's going to take some finagling. It's going to take some more one-time budget fixes, as you call them. But if you have the structural fix in place down the road, that's a lot easier to do than just saying, well, we're going to take one-time money and we're still going to be going down the tubes in our revenues.
So I need you on the record here. Would you consider K-12 cuts, not at the 5% level? Clearly, you're not going to go for that. But if you can come up with a structurally balanced budget, a third tax bracket, raising marginal rates, whatever that may be, could you go back to your superintendents and say, I need you to bull your neck on this, get through another year so that we, you know, so we have something good down the road. Can you take that?
Sam, my superintendent isn't the issue. I have already had that conversation, and our district could weather the storm.
Shawnee Mission.
Problem is, I have 80,000 constituents, and most of those people, not all, but most of them are adamant that we not cut K through 12. So to be on record, I don't know. I have to see the numbers. I don't want to cut the schools at all. But if it's the only way that we can get this all passed with enough votes in the Senate and the House, 2%, 1%, that's doable.
Brian?
So can you just talk about how the governor plays into maybe legislative leaders' decisions?
Well, I wish I was in their heads to understand that, because my understanding is that we have three branches of government for a reason, and that we as a legislature should have a plan. The governor can either approve or veto it, but it is our job to represent the people and to bring forward to the governor what we vote believing the people want. So when we were told that the only bill that could be brought forward had to be guaranteed that the governor would not veto that bill, well, I don't see that happening, because we have heard from the governor that he will veto anything that has the LLC exemption in it. Every one of us is voting for an LLC exemption repeal. So that's going to happen. So that's not even an attainable goal. They also said we had to do it with only Republican votes. And my comment was, every one of us was elected to get up here to fix this problem. And if those who think they weren't, well, that's their district's issue. But the ones I know, we have a problem to fix. And if we can't work together, all of us, to figure this out, then we're no better than Washington, D.C., and I don't even want to go there.
Now, the governor has had kind of a, let's just say, fraught relationship with Senate leadership. You know, he and Susan Weigel used to be pretty close allies.
Now they're at each other's throats.
Yeah, they've been whacking at each other in the press for more than a year now at this point. You don't get the sense that they're talking a lot. But what I do hear is that the governor is talking to the House side. So that's actually, I think, the thing that we should really watch this week, is things right now seem a little bit stalled in the Senate for
a bit.
But it sounds like the governor...
I think they're in the ditch is where I think you're not beyond stalled.
I was being diplomatic. But it sounds like the governor's been talking to House leadership. I think the House, you might see... I don't know if you'll see... You'll see a tax vote from the House, although there is a tax plan that did pass out of the committee the other day. But you may see a rescission bill emerge in the House, and that may actually be closer to the one that the governor proposed at the start of the session. And so it'll be very interesting to see if that can pass the House, and then if it does, what the Senate does with it. You know, this phrase structural fix, I think very few people look at the governor's plan and see a structural fix.
There is not one. Now, I do have some inside scoop that I saved just for this morning.
Well, then dish
Fire away,
my friend.
My understanding, I was told that on Tuesday we will put the Democratic tax plan through the tax committee and pass it out and run it on Thursday.
On the floor?
On the floor.
What's the Democratic tax plan?
My understanding, primarily, it is a three-bracketed tax plan.
I've got some of the details on that. So first, among other things, they are actually going to – one thing that the legislature did do in recent years is get rid of a lot of deductions or reduce those values. The Democrats would actually restore those deductions, but they are going to play with the rates. And the key, as the senator said, is that there will be a top rate of 6.45%. And what the talking point will be, that that's the tax on high-income Kansans. Now, that said, I think a lot of Kansans who will fall into that category won't necessarily consider themselves high-income Kansans, because for a single person, it's $35,000 or more a year, and for a married couple, it's $70,000. Now, that's higher than what the the highest bracket was before Brownback, but it still is something that I think, you know, that's one thing when we look at the tax bracket, so that somebody who's making $40,000 is going to be viewed the same as someone who's making $400,000. And so I think there still will be a little bit of a debate about really where you make that threshold for the quote unquote high income Kansan.
Right.
Now, I'm not wrong. I mean, moderates in the Senate are not opposed to a third income tax bracket, right? This is something that you guys could, right.
We have to have money in the state. We have a revenue crisis. Our bond ratings are going down. It is a disaster, and we cannot continue on this path.
And the third bracket will be, I think, as far as the tax debate goes, that will be the debate of the session, because we now have consensus on what has become the most politically toxic part of the governor's tax plan, which was the exemption for business owners. I think everyone, the idea that you have some people who are paying zero tax on their income, I think, has rubbed everyone the wrong way. And then it's really the question is, what do you do with rates? Because if you go with the GOP leadership plan, you have an increase to rates, but you don't create this three-bracket system. The Democrats are trying to bring back a three-bracket system, which is what Kansas had for years and years and years, with some slight tweaks. And that's going to be kind of the real question of, what do they do? And the plan that passed out of the House is also a three-bracket
exactly.
plan, but it's not as high a tax rate as the Democrats. So
right.
there seems to be a big idea of, we do need to restore the third tax bracket, because that's actually arguably where Kansas lost the most amount of revenue.
It's not even arguably.
Yeah.
We 70% yeah. was what was – it was a 70% on the income tax, 30% on the LLC exemption.
We have to leave it there. Brian Lauer from the Kansas City Star, always good to have you back at this table. Senator Barbara Boyer from Mission Hills, this, as you know, is where we turn State House Blend over to you to hear what our walk-off music is going to be. Last time we had the pleasure, you walked off with Happy, and I guess I'm asking, how happy are you today?
This time, my theme song for the year is the Beatles, It's Been a Long, Cold, Lonely Winter, Here Comes the Sun.
State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. I'm Sam Zeff. I'll see you around the radio.
Sign up for full episodes of State House Blend Kansas and Missouri, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, we check in with our friends from Harvest Public Media for the latest on GMOs and a new Secretary of Agriculture. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.